This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on February the 18th, 2000. Our speaker is Mike V. of San Jose, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Mike and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank the 300 or 400 people here tonight.
That was just for the tape coordinator. Okay.
I was just telling Ken that I don't care if you drink coffee while I'm speaking. You know, I've had people cuss me out and leave. You know, getting up getting a cup of coffee doesn't trip me out at all. I'd like to thank Mark, our speaker coordinator, for telling me that I was going to do this. If you're new here, watch out for the alcoholics. They'll get you to do things you don't really want to do, but you're supposed to be, okay, I'll do this and I'll do that, and I'm not one of those kind of guys. I'm just getting better at it. I was sitting in a meeting, and I was kind of prepared to say, no, I don't want to do any speaker meetings. I don't want to be in that kind of service. That was going to be what I was going to say. And I was sitting at in a chair, and he goes, have you done a speaker meeting before? I go, no. He goes, good, you're going to do it on the 18th. I went, damn. I didn't get to say no the way I wanted to. I used to come to for the first couple of years of my sobriety, I would come to the 8 o'clock speaker meetings because I knew that I wouldn't be called on to share. And, because I absolutely knew when I got here that you guys wanted to hear what I had to say. And that's self-centeredness to the max. And I was frightened of that. So I would come in. Before I came to the meetings is I would go outside, drive over into the parking lot, and I would fake like I was reading and watch who was coming in, you know, and try to go, okay, that looks like a chairperson, that looks like a secretary, you know, and then I would come in and see who was chairing the meeting, and if they even remotely knew me, I would leave and just come back to the next meeting, and that was kind of like the 8 o'clock meeting, the speaker meeting is where I could relax and be okay with it. And that was just the way my introduction to 8 o'clock speaker meetings were. And I really wasn't listening to anybody. I was just kind of sitting there relaxing. I started my day off great today. I got up this morning early. And I got to tell you this, my wife is here tonight, and whom I just love dearly, and she's been with me for about 28 years now, so we have a lot of history together, and we've gone through a lot of things together, and 3 years into my sobriety, and I'll jump around a little bit, 3 years into my sobriety, I had saved enough of my money from not drinking to buy a real nice offshore fishing boat. And I've just been digging that thing for the last couple of years, but it's getting too small. So, okay. So you know where I'm going. So I'm looking, I got the internet. I can look all over the world for a boat now, just by my fingertips. I mean, I'm tripping on this thing. And I found one in Rhode Island, okay? The one I want. And I emailed the yacht broker, and the guy faxed me a quote on it. And this morning, my wife goes, Mike, yes, honey. And she goes, weren't you going to discuss this major purchase with me before you went out and bought this boat? And she goes, you know, if you spend that kind of money, she goes, we're going to get a divorce. That's what she told me. We're going to get, first thing in the morning. We're going to get divorced. And so, if you're new here, I'll tell you, I've been here for, well, March 2nd, 1994 is my sobriety date, so it's 5 years, 11 months, and a couple of weeks. And I've done the steps, and I'm a saint, and all this other stuff, and I'm sitting there, and I listen to her, you know, and I start thinking of all the things we've been through, and how much, God, I just love this woman so much, you know, and how kind she's been to me, and, you know, and then I said to her, we're gonna get a divorce? And she said, yeah, and if I get this boat, and yeah. I looked at her with much, much love. And I said, God, I'm going to miss you. Because I want the boat, man. You know. Priorities. So I'd like to welcome the newcomers. And, you know, I'm not well yet. I was talking to a guy today. I was talking to this guy that works for me, and he told me, he goes, you should be institutionalized. And I thought, you know, I am institutionalized. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, this is kind of like an institutionalized type thing, to me. You know, bar setting, that's institutionalized, AA, it's kind of just the gauntlet that we run. But what I've gathered from the people that I've heard before me who speak at speaker meetings, because this is the first one I've done, they go, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So what I think it was like, this is how it goes for me, what I think it was like, what I think happened, and my perception of what's going on now. Okay, that's me. I don't know what everybody else does. Okay, basically, probably half the stuff you're going to hear didn't really happen. Okay, I can't. You know what? I drank enough to float a battleship around, and I took enough drugs to be two times an addict. So you know, I've read police reports, and I go, and they got my name on it, and I could swear to God that wasn't me there. I didn't do that, but they have it written down. And I, you know what? I think they lie too. I don't know. If you've ever been incarcerated, or been charged, or been arrested or anything, I think that they add a little bit on their own too. But, that's on them. So I'll tell you what it was like for me, or what I think it was like. I'm a West Coast child. I was born June 10th, 1956, in San Francisco, California, and grew up in Belmont. If anybody knows where Belmont is, it was a kind of an upper white middle class. We lived right next to Hillsboro, you know, and we hung with it was all white kids. You know, we're just, I didn't really get to see any kind of colors of anything or any kind of other nationalities until I started drinking, you know. then I ventured out from the nest, you know. When I was a kid, my mother is just, my mother is the only saint that I really have, my only hero in my entire life. She's a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Swede from Minnesota. And my father's a fiery Spaniard from New Mexico. And those two people should never have gotten together, but they did. And had three children by that union. My brother, who's 11 months, 2 weeks younger than me, and my sister, who's a couple of years older than me. I just got a wedding invitation to go to her wedding. She's marrying a professional gambler in Vegas. So it's all a roll of the dice. I always figured, you know, and, you know, this will be her fourth time around. It is a roll of the dice. She brought him over to meet me to get my approval. This guy is like 57, 58 years old, you know, and so I was watching how he was eating, you know? How do you give somebody your approval, you know, and they're older than you and done everything else, you know? Well, you know, he's got good table manners, Jessica, and, you know, he's a gambler. I guess that's a good thing, you know. He's not a drunk. But my mother and father, they raised us up in Belmont, and as a child, my mother was a Jehovah's Witness, and my father was a Catholic, and those two religions shouldn't mix either, and we just clashed as children, and my mother took us to church, did a lot of church work. I went Tuesday nights for an hour of Bible study, Thursday nights for 2 hours, and then Sunday went for 2 hours, and they had a speaker meeting, and then we'd go out into the service and out into the neighborhoods, and I was the little kid that would knock on your door, if you've ever had little kids knock on your door, and try to sell you Watchtower and Awakes and try to convert you. I'm 7 years old, and I'm trying to convert you. It wasn't, you know, it looked like a Martian when I came to the door. You know, just please buy my magazines, man. You know, I don't know why I'm here, what I'm doing. They got me dressed up in this suit. I'm trapped, actually. You know, they're making me do this stuff. They're making me do this. When you're a kid and your parent, you got to go to church, you know. And when I hear people go that they felt different, all from when they were a little kid and everything. And, you know, and I always trip out on that. Because in the religion that I was in, we couldn't do any holidays. They all had there was always some negative thing during the holidays. I mean, no Christmas, no Halloween, Valentine's Day. What other are the popular ones that we have? You know, all those. And I couldn't do those kind of things because those were pagan practices. And I forget what the consequences were that something bad was going to happen if I did that stuff. And I would go to school, and we had at that time, and I don't know if they still do it, but they have the Pledge of Allegiance. But Michael had to go up to the teacher and say, let's see, what did my mom make me go say? I couldn't pledge allegiance to an earthly government because my allegiance was to a heavenly government. 32 other students would stand up while Mike sat in his seat. Now, I was a dirty red commie bastard when I was a kid because all the other kids would stand up and I was there, and you're always in the spotlight. So I was always different than these kids, okay? And I couldn't really explain it other than, well, my mom told me I couldn't do this. And I would go to, like, Christmas. My dad had, you know, my dad's family, they're great people. They like to party, and they love their children. And my dad would take me and my brother and my sister to the Christmas things, and my mother was just furious over these kind of things, but she would let us go and she would prep me before we went. And I go, well, when they say Merry Christmas, Mom, what do I say? And she goes, well, you just tell them to have a nice day. Well, I'll tell you something. You go to a bunch of Spaniards who are Catholics and who are Christmas people, you don't tell them to have a nice day. You say Merry Christmas, okay? But I can't say Merry Christmas. And I would go, my dad would take us over to my Aunt Stella's house, and walking up that stairway, I would just look at that door, and I knew that my Aunt Stella was going to be standing at that door, and when that door opened up, the first thing she was going to say to me was, Merry Christmas, Mike. And I would have to go, you have a nice day too, Aunt Stella. You know, she goes, no, Merry Christmas. And, you know, my dad would hit me in the back, and, oh, man, you know. And then I would have to go cop to my mom, and I said, like, Merry Christmas. She called me a pagan and all this other stuff, and, oh, my God. You know, I'd bring, I'd bring presents home, man. I was going to hell for sure. And you know, what we taught in our religion and what we had to do in our religion was, in 1974, there was going to be a hell on earth. There's going to be an Armageddon going to happen. And, you know, so I'm 8, 9 years old, and I'm over there selling magazines. I'm going to church 3 times a week. I'm trying to fit in with the kids, which I don't fit in with because I can't do anything that they do. And I'm telling people that they're going to die in 1974 if they don't join up over here, right? Oh, I'm feeling part of here, you know. So I'm preaching this kind of stuff, and at about 12 years old, on the way to the bus stop one day to go, I was in the 7th grade, Chuck Babb whips out a joint and goes, "Here, let's smoke this." And I'd never smoked before, I'd never done any of that kind of stuff before, and I went, "Well, okay." And that was the start of my smoking dope days in 7th grade. And things started changing for me after I started smoking dope. You know, I still wasn't part of, and I didn't feel part of anything, but I would hear voices and stuff, which was cool for me, you know. I would go to school and I would hear things, you know, where'd that come from? And then I would try to be straight, but I didn't know what, like, trying to be straight was, you know, and so that scared me, but I, you know, it was a thing to do. Chuck Babb always had dope, and we roll up these big bombers, and we used to roll stems and seeds in our weed, you know. Never had any, you know, green killer bud that they have today, you know, the good stuff. This was like skunk, you know, this is like 4 feet, you know, big old wads of stuff, and we'd roll it up, and pow, you know, they boom, pow, you know. You're always licking it, trying to keep it from running, you know, not like the good stuff we got today. You can relate to that, huh? Yeah, I know. This was back in the 60s. So I'm doing this, and I'm going to church, and I'm selling stuff, and I'm going knocking on doors. Got my suit and tie on. I used to get up in front of this, in front of the congregation, with my suit and tie, and I had a script, and my mom would have written down stuff for me, and I would open the Bible, and I would preach out of the Bible, and it would say gesture, and I would gesture, and go like this, and I would do it. Did. I would have it, and then I would go sit down, and the brothers would critique me. You know, well, your bottom button on your suit wasn't button, Mike, you know, and not chastise you in front of 300 people, you know. I hated suits. Cheryl goes, "How come you don't wear a suit?" I go, "I don't even have a suit." So now I'm just not very part of these kind of things, but I'm smoking dope now, and, you know, and my mind starts working, because back in this early, when I was 12 years old, I started looking at girls different after I'm smoking dope. And Cindy Rose would get off the bus, she'd wear a miniskirt, and just, oh my God, man, she looked like she was 21 years old. She was only 12, you know, and I'm stoned, and I'm, oh, wow. Mr. Maxim used to send her home because her skirt was too short. And I would always get off the bus first. So, because I knew her skirt was too short, but I get to see it first before they sent her home. And, we're looking for it at 12 years old now. So all these thoughts are entering my mind while I'm smoking dope and looking at the girls and coming off the bus, the hot pants, the miniskirts, and I'm just going, God. And that's when I started having sex. No, there was nobody else there with me, but that's when I started having sex. My whole world changed, man. You know, I was smoking dope, having sex. I'm like getting there now. I'm getting, you know. But my mind's all twisted up because I'm not part of, you know, and I can't, you know, play with those kids. My dad had me work. My dad's idea was fun was work. So if I wasn't working or going to church or going to school, that's what, you know, I'm working all the time. And, you know, and I thank God for him because he worked 7 days a week, all the time. And he gave me a really good work ethic. I'm really broken down now, 43, but he gave me a good work ethic. So I'm 12 years old, I'm smoking dope, and I'm having sex, and I'm rolling on through life, and I get into high school, and things are looking good. And 1974 is coming up, too, because you guys are all going to die, and I'm going to be here. But the thing about it is, and I thought about it today, was, you know what, man? I would have to be with those people. You know, I would have to be with those tight asses my whole forever. You were going to be able to live forever on a perfect earth. But I was going to have to live with them. No premarital sex, no booze, no pot, no nothing. You know, what's so perfect about that? So, but I don't know this yet. But I can see the end coming in 1974, and I'm tripping on this. But now I'm doing all these other kind of things, and my mind starts get a little bit distorted. And at 15 years old, I'm a sophomore, I met her. Okay? I met her. And her is sitting in the back row. Okay? And I remember, it was like burned into my memory. I fell in love at first. It was one of those love at first sight things. Because I know exactly what she was wearing. You know, exactly what she looked like. And it, you know, my whole world just it got real small. I got like little tunnel vision. My hearing went out. You know, I couldn't hear anybody anymore. People were talking, but all I can do is see this right here. And it gave me like a new direction in life. Her. She gave me a new direction because I'm smoking dope. I'm having sex by myself. But you know what? A partner would be even better. That's when I started drinking, after I met her. Now, that may be a coincidence, but I don't know. All I know is I want what she has, okay? You know what they have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it. She's willing to go to any length to get it, too. You know, we're 15, we're still awkward a little bit, and so we strike up a little relationship, and we become an item, and I think after, you know, I'm not going to tell you the exact details, but sometime between right now and when I was 15, we started having sex. So now I'm just having a great old time. 1974 comes and passes. Nothing happened. Nothing happened, okay? I graduated from high school, okay? The world didn't come to an end. I went and asked my mom. I go, I've been going for 17 years. People in our congregation were selling their houses, selling their businesses, okay, consolidating their money, just giving it away and stuff. Nothing happened. They're out on the streets and stuff. And I go ask my mom, I go, what happened? She goes, well, Michael, you know, what are you going to tell the kid, man? You know, it didn't happen. You know, my whole life was for all this kind of stuff. And it didn't happen. And she goes, well, we may have had a little time frame difference, you know. And, you know, it's a Bible, so, you know, it could be a couple thousand years or, you know. It was like they picked a number out of the sky and said 74. So it just blew my mind. And the God that she introduced me to when I was a kid, who I still have today, went right out the window. I demanded an apology from the congregation. Okay? I want a goddamned apology. I want you to apologize now to me. Okay? Or else I'm not coming anymore. They didn't care. They didn't care. Can you imagine that? It's like, okay, you know, door's open. See you later. And that kind of like changed my whole reality of things, man. I had lost my faith at that point in time. But I had started drinking, and I was smoking dope, and I had me a gal now. So, and I'm 17, 18 years old. What really else do you need? Nothing. I'm going to live forever, right? And I got my gal, I got my booze, I got my dope, I got... What else do you need? Well, you need a job and you have some money. Okay, I can do that because I like... I could work. And so after I graduated from high school, I worked with my dad for a couple of years at about... We were starting to drink pretty heavily at that time. And, you know, I kind of look back at when I kind of like switched over from being just a hardcore drinker to an alcoholic. And somewhere, you know, I hear people say you go from fun to fun with problems to problems. Well, I got a DUI when I was 19. Started drinking at 16, got a DUI at 19. I guess my fun came in within a couple of years there. But I was having fun. And we would go to these parties, and Cheryl would go with me, and I was one of those guys that would get there first and leave there last, always. And that's just the way I did it. And we went to this one party one night, and I started getting into methamphetamines, and those were really freaking me out. And I started hearing things, and I remember I went to this party, and I was on the third story, and I was in having a beer, and I was just amping on this stuff. And I walked outside, and I got over towards the edge just to look, and I hear this jump, you know? And I back away, and I'm looking at it, and I'm looking around, and I get closer to it, and I hear it jump, you know, and it's freaking me out, because if I get closer, and it's getting louder, and I get a little further away, you know, so I don't go near the edge anymore. I mean, that was pretty simple, but, you know, it was that's when the drugs started taking over, and the alcohol started taking over, and at that same very party, we were on the third floor, and I was 18 or 19 years old at the time, and I would drink until I would puke. And I was one of those projectile puker guys. And, you know, it wasn't nothing pretty. You know, I puked in everywhere. And I was in the, they were throwing us out, and we were in the elevator. There was like 7, 8 people mashed into this thing, and I'm standing in the back of the elevator. Maintaining. I'm maintaining now, okay? And you know how it is. You feel it coming up, and your lips start to get a little wet, you know. Somebody pushes the button, we're going down, man. I'm going to make it to the first floor, and I'm out of there, right? We start going down. All of a sudden, boom, second floor, the door opens up. Well, the party got too loud. There was a cop standing there, and he's looking for the party, okay? I don't know anybody that I used to hang out with that just could not, they just got to say something to the cop. You know, and I don't even remember what it was, but it was stopping the elevator, and because I'm starting to puke, and from the back of the elevator, I push the guy into the cop, and the door shuts, and we start going back down, right? Fuck him, you know, get him out of here, man. Door shuts, we're going down. I'm making it. And then we start getting down, now it's coming up. And I have this sweatshirt on. It's a pullover sweatshirt. I pull my sweatshirt off, and I got my head in the hood part of it. And it goes, and it starts squirting out the sides. The door opens up. People are like, they're on fire. And they're just like, running away from me, you know. I, you know, and what do you do with your best sweatshirt, man, you know? I think Cheryl cleaned it for me, but I'm not sure. And that's the kind of people we got to go party with and play with. And, I started trying to have to get serious about my life at 21 years old, or 2 weeks before I turned 21, Cheryl and I got married. And because that's what you do, I guess. You know, I mean, that's what my parents did. I remember my dad coming after my mom, and my mom would have an iron in her hand when there used to be irons. And he'd come after her, and, you know, and be hot iron, and he'd go to hit her, and she'd, you know, and he always had bandages on his forearms. You know, she had the ironing board in, you know, it was so cute. It was really, you know, and, I mean, but it scared the hell out of us, or me, because I was always afraid of him. And, you know, and then the police would come and, you know, and escort my dad away, you know, before they, you know, they would just take him for a couple hours. Maybe, I don't know where they brought him. I never did ask, you know, not like today when you got to go to domestic violence counseling and all that kind of stuff, you know. But that's the kind of parents that, you know, you looked at people and you say, okay, you know, the next thing you do is you go get married. You know, I really love this gal. And so we got married and we went on our, you know, on our wedding, I was, you know, I don't remember what I said, but they said I said it. And, you know, it's like, do you honor and obey and all that other good stuff, you know, but I was so cloaked out, I couldn't get the, yeah, you know, you're grinding away, you're trying to say I do, you know, and the guy's standing there, and you got all these people behind you, and you're just like wrenching on words, and we had a beautiful reception, and we did $600 worth of damage because all my buddies were shooting the champagne corks into the lights and stuff, and, you know, these are the type of people that I hung out with. They just, anywhere they went, they tore things up and broke things. But, you know, it was still a good thing. Cheryl's mom and dad paid for all the damage, so it didn't really bother me any. And you know, one thing I did, you know, I asked Cheryl one time, I go, you know, when did you know that I was an alcoholic, now that we've talked about it at some length? And she said, you know, when we got back from our honeymoon, 2 days later, a buddy of mine called at about 11:30, 12 o'clock on a Friday night, and I went out. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, okay, Scott. And she goes, and you just picked up and left. And that started what I did on a, not on a daily basis, but on a daily and a half basis, probably. And that went on probably, well, I joined the Carpenters Union, and I became an apprentice carpenter. Everybody that I knew drank as an apprentice carpenter. We all drank, we all played around on the jobs and stuff, and I was making $5.65 an hour, and this is a very important thing. Cheryl came up to me one day, and she goes, I don't want to do what I'm doing anymore. I go, what do you want to do, hon? And she goes, I want to be an artist. So I was living up in Belmont at the time. We were living in San Mateo at the time, and sent her down to San Jose State, and she graduated with an art degree of great distinction, top 5% of her class. And the reason that I sent her there is because I didn't want her to come bitching and moaning at me later on down the road that she didn't know what to do with her life, you know? And that was my motive. That was just my motive at the time. And my motive for getting married to her, because I just needed to have it with me at all times, you know, and it was just a lustful type of thing for there, you know, but it's worked out. That's why I tell people, I go, it's just a roll of the dice, man. You know, say I do, get on with it and just do it and we'll see what happens, you know. And you can't do any worse than anybody else, I don't think. And the way I look at it is I'm only as good as today anyway. You know, all the past is, that's gone, you know. So what, if I get brownie points today, I'm doing great. And if you are, you're doing great too. And so she said at about when I was a couple of days, she knew that I was just on my own at 25 years old. Just kept on going and going and going. At 25 years old, she came up to me and had these divorce papers and said, I can't take it anymore. You're going to have to... I don't know if I was supposed to stop drinking, snorting coke, doing methamphetamines. You know, I forget what she wanted me to stop, but it was like maybe all of it. And I said, you know, and I looked at that, and I looked at those papers, and I looked at her, and she has a different way of looking at it. She said she brought me some other kind of papers, but I thought it was divorce papers at the time because that's where my mind was thinking. And I said, no, I'll never do better than you, and, you're the love of my life, and blah, blah, blah. So I had to go, I had to cool it. I had to stop drinking in front of her, okay? We don't never stop drinking, okay? I don't know about you. Well, I do know some of you anyway. So I had to go about hiding it now. Or not hiding it, but you know, it's like when you talk to a cop. How many of you had a couple? You know, I mean, I always had a couple. And that went on till I was 28 years old. And Cheryl gave birth to my son, Daniel, who is now 15 years old, coming up on 16 here pretty soon. And I started, as the disease progresses, all these things started happening for me. My son was born, and 2 years later, I hit a bottom with my drinking and drugging, and quit drinking for 4 months. Successfully quit drinking for 4 months. Didn't have a drink. So that proved to me that I really didn't have a drinking problem because I could quit anytime I wanted. Case closed. Okay? We would do things as a family, and I remember we would go to, Disneyland. And, you know, they call Disneyland the happiest place on earth. I think they got a sign out there that says the happiest place on earth. Not for an alcoholic that can't drink in Disneyland is Disneyland the happiest place on earth. They don't serve alcohol there, as far as I know. And, you know, and I would go in there and this is when I just had to have alcohol. I'm craving this stuff, and we would go in there, and I'd try to be a family. And we'd walk through, you know, the frontier, you know, the front gate, and we'd go on rides, and I'm looking around saying, you know, well, you know, a guy told me one time that they do serve alcohol, but it's in some swinging gate place. You got to go look, and you know, and it's real secret type stuff. And so I'm looking. I mean, you know, I'm biting on that one, you know, and because I can't have a drink all day long. And Disneyland stays open till like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning or 1 o'clock in the morning. So I'm going to go from 8 to 1. Okay, what to do? What to do? Okay, hang tough, man. And so I'm having family time at the happiest place on earth, not being able to have a drink. And I need a drink bad. I need a drink bad. And we get up in these, I don't know what they're on a wire. They're like a mushroom, and you go through, and it takes you through the Matterhorn, and it takes you around, you know. And I'm looking for places to, you know, just where they're selling beer. It's the only ones that goddamn beer. You know, my wife is going, oh, look at that family. Oh, look at those Mickey Mouse ears. You know, yeah, that's really cool. You know, and I'm just going, God, I need a beer really bad, you know. And then some clown, you know, two mushrooms up, fires up a joint, you know, and I just, I want to jump is what I want to do. I swear to God that I wanted to jump. That was really, you know, and I was just going, oh, God, you know. And then we got off over by, like, Fantasyland, and she wanted to go on the Dumbo ride, and you know, while I'm drinking, I'm getting like way big, and I'm 270 pounds, and you can't get two of me on the Dumbo ride, you know, and I don't want to go on the Dumbo ride, man, you know. And you know, my wife, don't mind going to Dumbo ride. Me and Dan, we'll go into the front Dumbo. You go into this. My, you know, they take off. My Dumbo don't go up. My Dumbo. They got this big, fat, stupid, drunk guy, me, going around, circles, pulling on that lever, you know. They're all going up and down. I'm looking at all the people. They're laughing at me. You know, and, you know, being humiliated when you're drunk ain't so bad. But if you're sober and you're jonesing and you need a drink really bad, people laughing at you, that's humiliating. You know, and I just want to get off this goddamn Dumbo. And I, you know what, man, the idea comes through my mind. Get over to Frontierland, man. Frontierland, they gotta have a bar in Frontierland, right? Any movie you've ever seen, a Western movie, has a bar. I know they got a bar. We get off that Dumbo ride. Cheryl, I gotta go over to Frontierland for a little while. I don't tell them why I gotta go to Frontierland, but I gotta go to Frontierland, man. You know, and then I got to go look at the other drunks that can't find a bar either. They're there. They're at the firing range. They're shooting shit. They're so mad. You know? Then I got to go over to New Orleans land, or what is it, Mardi Grasville over there. And, you know, they got those stupid drinks that they don't have no liquor in them or anything like that. And, you know, I'll tell you something. If you're new here, there is such a big difference for me in having to drink and going someplace and not having to drink. I get to go places now and I don't have to drink. I don't know if Dumbo will go up or down now, you know. I don't really care. I'll get on Dumbo. I'll put the ears on and stuff. But it's just that to me is a real big difference today is I don't have to. And I had to then. Oh, I'll just jump to, should I get sober yet? Okay, I picked up another drunk driver when I was 25. I finally hit bottom, had a moment of clarity in San Jose County Jail. I got picked up one more time for another DUI. My wife had told me about a month early that I had to go get help. I said, I'll just quit. You know, and that was I can't quit anymore. That's nonsense. But I thought I could. And I came in here, and I was 270 pounds, and I was yellow, I was jaundiced, and I was dying, is what happened to me. You know, all the laughs and fun. I got a million stories, but the culmination of the whole thing, being this is a progressive disease, was I hit bottom when I was in San Jose jail. And I remember I don't remember actually almost hitting the CHP, but she said I did. I was in a blackout, and when she pulled me over, she was just a little gal. But all you know, when a cop is a cop to me. Don't run from female cops; they'll shoot you with cause. That's what she told me. She goes, if you run or if you strike me, I'm going to shoot you. And I'm thinking, for a drunk driving man, what's up with this? You know, for 12 years prior, they didn't do that. And like when I was 19, it was almost, oh man, you shouldn't have been doing that, you know? And she asked, what she did ask me was, are you suicidal? And I knew a buddy of mine got busted twice in a week or 2 weeks for drunk driving, and he told the cop, why don't you just shoot me? And they put him on a 72-hour hold for being suicidal. And I said, no. She goes, well, what are you going to do? And I go, I don't know. I'll just deal with it. She goes, you got a wife and kids? And I go, yeah. She goes, well, what are you going to do with them? I go, I'm just going to deal with this. And I got into jail. And it all kind of came down on me that night, March 1st of 94. And what kept coming through my mind is you're committing suicide and you're dying and you can't stop. Period. And this is your life. This is the way your life is going to be. It ain't never going to change. You're 37 years old, and here it is. And then I looked down on the floor. There was about five drunks passed out. And when I got into jail, I was better than them. When I left jail, I was all of them. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous the next morning. I looked in the Yellow Pages, actually. And called the hotline, and some guy said, hey, we're just one drunk talking to another. Come on down there. Go to this meeting. And I sobbed all day long because they towed my car up top of the hill in Santa Cruz, for God, way up there, you know. And that was humiliating and costly. So I went to my first meeting. I don't remember anything that they said. I honest to God don't remember anything they said. They gave me a book though. I had $2 on me, and they gave me a book and one of these directional things to find another meeting. And the next meeting I went to a men's meeting and I was looking for a sponsor, and there was like 500 guys there, and I was scared and I didn't know what to do. And you know, I went up and asked the guy if I need to get a sponsor, and he goes, well, just ask any one of these, motherfucker. That's what he called me, you know, and I was going, man, you know, I go, this is bad. You know, why are they calling me that kind of stuff? And I'm turning around. I'm looking. I thought he was talking to somebody else for a second, you know. And I went home, and my wife was going, what did they say, Mike? What did they say? And I go, well, Cheryl, they called me a motherfucker. She goes, yeah, I know, but, you know, what did they say, you know. And it was nothing but good when I got sober, man. It rocketed right away. You know, and I was standing up at meetings saying I was an alcoholic. I didn't buy it. I wasn't going to buy it. I think this is a disease that tells you you don't have it, and I didn't have it when I got here. And I remember after I finally came to the conclusion that I was an alcoholic, when a guy said he got up here. After 15 days I was here, I went to like 30 meetings, and this guy gets up and goes, sober beats drunk. And I went, sober beats drunk. And it hit me that I didn't even know what sober was. So, you know. And then I knew I was an alcoholic, and I went home and told my wife I was an alcoholic, and she goes, oh man, I was a bummer, because I was hoping you weren't an alcoholic, you know. God bless her, I love her, she's with me on this kind of stuff, man, all through all the things that we went through, you know, she was pulling for me. We went to a family therapist, because she had it through her work, and went through, like, I went once, told the guy everything. I just laid it all out there, because if you tell them everything, then you're done, right? That's what I thought. Just tell them everything. It'll be over. They go, okay, deem you whatever, you know, or buttonhole your ear, or give you something, you know, and cut you loose. I'm done. Right on. Oh. Second, he wanted me to bring my wife in the next time. I go, I don't think that's a good idea. She's a little upset right now about this kind of stuff, because I want to see her anyway. I brought her in, and I said, you know what? I go, you know, don't mess with her too much. You know, she's kind of a little unstable right now. It's kind of angry, you know, and I just got out of jail, blah, 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 in my house. I was sleeping in my bed, and my roof had been leaking for about 3 or 4 years, and when it rained, my wife would put Visqueen over me. I mean, you know, all my fences were blown down, the weeds were this high. It wasn't nothing but good. It just wasn't. It wasn't good. I could paint a really bad picture, but, you know, it wasn't good. And he had the audacity to tell her, you need to go to the Al-Anon program. And I went, oh, my God. Why did he say that? And she goes, it's his goddamn problem. It's not mine. It's his. And she shut up. That was it. And I looked at the guy and go, what'd you do that for, man? And I go, now she's not going to say nothing. And he started asking her questions, and she wouldn't say nothing. She said, look at him. I go, you know, I'm going to have to go home with her. I'm paying this guy what? Oh, well, insurance is paying what, 65, 70 bucks an hour for this creep? And I got to go home with this. But anyway, so I got a sponsor. And at about a month sober, my wife comes up to me. And I was feeling really good. And she goes, you know what? It's always been about you then. It's always about you now. You're always going to those goddamn meetings, blah, blah, blah. And she goes, hey, you know what? She goes, I'm going to tell you something. She goes, in the last 4 years, she goes, you spent $100,000 on your drinking. I was feeling way good that day. And then she told me that, and I felt, whoa, bad again, you know. So it's been an up and down thing for me, and that was the reality of the way it was for me. And I started taking the steps, and at the time we had this thing at 90 days you would become a secretary of a meeting, and I saw people having fun. I didn't feel part of Alcoholics Anonymous at all. Like I said, I was pretty frightened. I thought you were all going to call me. I didn't know what to say. You know, I mean, you're talking a totally different language than me. You know, like resentment. And I was going, what the hell is your resentment, man? I'm pissed. You know, and that's what it means. You're pissed off, you know. But we call it resentments, you know, so we can have little keywords. I guess so if you're out there in the world and somebody gets all pissed off, if you go, oh, you got a resentment? Oh, you're a friend of Bill Wilson? Oh, la, 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 la. You know, we all la, la, dee, da, down the, you know. Because I hear these, you know, I hear people, you know, do these little phrases and stuff, you know, and I am total anonymous when I'm out there. Because I've had people ask me, are you a friend of Bill Wilson? Who? What? Who? What? You know, I got a little sticker on the back of my window on my truck, and people ask me, and I go, I bought the truck. It was on there, man. Screw you. Drink. I'm anonymous, man. I'm practicing the spiritual, what is that? The spiritual, thing of anonymity here. So anyway, where was I now? Oh, I was sober. So after about a year of staying sober, or 2 years of staying sober, I finally started feeling a little bit part of this place, you know, and that was a good thing for me. Is you know, I don't know how many people stood up as new today, but I'm going to go ahead and cut you guys loose, and I'm going to read one thing out of the big book. I told my wife, I said, you know what, honey, either it's going to be a real long hour or it's going to be a real short one, and I don't know how it's gone for you, but I'm going to read this, and it pretty much sums up everything that I've said today or tonight, and it's in the big book. This is our basic text, if you don't know, and it's from the Doctor Alcoholic Addict, and I'll read it real quick, and then I'll get to the end of it, so I'll cut you loose. The longer the drinking continued, the shorter the time the alcohol would keep me asleep. I would have to drink myself back to sleep again and again throughout the night, but I never became a morning drinker. Okay? I had a 5 a.m. shutoff time. That's not really morning. If it was 1 minute after 5, I'd drink myself back to sleep. If I was 1 minute after, I'd stay up and act like a martyr all day. It became progressively harder to get up in the morning until one day I asked myself what I would do for a patient who felt this rotten. The answer came right back. I'd give him something to pep him up. So I immediately started taking and shooting pep pills. Eventually, I was taking 45 milligrams of the long-acting Benzedrine and 45 of the short-acting just to get out of bed in the morning. I took more through the day to increase the high, more to maintain it. When I overshot the mark, I would take tranquilizers to level it off. The pep pills affected my hearing at times. I couldn't listen fast enough to hear what I was saying. I think, I wonder why I'm saying that again. I've already said it 3 times. Still, I couldn't turn my mouth off. For the leveling off process, you're an AA here. For the leveling off process, I just loved intravenous Demerol. I found it hard to shoot good to practice good medicine. This guy's an MD. To practice good medicine while shooting morphine, following an injection, I would keep one hand busy scratching my constantly itching nose, and would also have sudden uncontrollable urges to vomit. I never got much effect out of codeine and Percodin and the tranquilizers. However, for a period of time, I was injecting pentothal intravenously to put myself to sleep. That's the stuff used when the oral surgeon puts a needle in your vein and says, count to 10, before you're at 2, you're asleep. Instant blackout, what it was, and it seemed delightful. I didn't feel I could lie in the bed and squirt the stuff in my veins while my kids and my wife stood around watching me, so I kept the drug in my bag and a bag in the car and the car in the garage. Luckily, the garage was attached to the house. In the garage, I would put the needle in my vein and then try to figure out exactly how much medication to inject to overcome the pep pills while adding to the sleeping pills while ignoring the tranquilizers in order to get just enough to be able to pull out the needle, jerk the tourniquet, throw it in the car, slam the car door, run down the hall, and fall into bed before I fell asleep. Okay. I don't know, I can't relate to any of that, but the next sentence I can relate to. And if you can too, you belong here, and I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. The next sentence reads, it was hard to judge the right amount. If you can't judge the right amount, you're in the right place too. I'd like to thank everybody for listening tonight. Good night.